But if you see it, don't get to the theater late, because the most important scene comes during the first couple of minutes. So if you walk in 5 minutes late, you will have missed the most important scene of the entire film. And that scene has, first of all, a white soldier is trying to recite the Gettysburg Address, and he kind of stammers and forgets the last part of it. So it is the black soldier who has really memorized it, so that when the white soldier stammers, the black soldier confidently recites it to the end. Now, never mind that this could not possibly have happened, because the means of communication, you know, we didn't have, they didn't have ways of transcribing and communicating speeches like, you know, now all we have to do is, you know, look up on the internet what Barack Obama said yesterday and we'll find it. But nonetheless, it was important. And what was important was that the black soldier emphasizes the pivotal role that black people played in the war. And this was, I mean, this is especially important now in light of the fact, as we commemorate the sesquicentennial of the Gettysburg Address, not a single black soldier was buried in the cemetery that was inaugurated by the Gettysburg Address. W.E.B. Du Bois, in chapter 4 of his book, Black Reconstruction, and I hope many of you have read Black Reconstruction. I see some heads shaking. How many of you have actually read it? Okay. I wish 20 times as many people had read it. It is perhaps the single most important text about U.S. history. So tell your history professors, or if your history professors are not receptive, read it anyway. In chapter 4 of Black Reconstruction, Du Bois describes the slaves who join the Union Army, which ultimately made it possible for the Union to be victorious and ultimately pave the way for the nation we know today. Du Bois describes them as strikers. He called them an army of striking labor. And maybe because he uses Marxist terminology, maybe that's why you don't know the book. Because what he said was that black people decided to go on strike against the slaveholders and transfer their labor from the plantations and the farms and the houses to the Union Army. And he said that this army of striking labor eventually provided the 200,000 soldiers, quote, whose evident ability to fight decided the war. And they were not all men. There were women as well. As a matter of fact, I earlier evoked Harriet Tubman, who was a soldier and a spy for the Union Army. But when the war was over, they refused to give her a soldier's pension. And she fought for 3 decades until she finally received her soldier's pension. One of the most hidden eras of U.S. history is the period of radical reconstruction. And that is the period following the end of the Civil War. It's certainly the most radical period in the history of this country, where black people were elected to office, where there was a campaign for public education, And as a matter of fact, many people to this day are not aware of the extent to which that campaign for public education waged by former slaves brought education to the children of white poor people who otherwise never had the opportunity to go to school. And I think that's a lesson for New Orleans today, too. Especially given the fact that the teachers of this city, that all of the teachers were fired, right? I mean, have you ever heard of such a thing? Some 7,500 teachers, the majority of whom were black, and they've been replaced by a majority of out-of-town teachers in a setting of privatized schools. This is a prime example of what Naomi Klein has called disaster capitalism. Disaster capitalism. Private schools, and don't let me get started talking about the private prisons in this state. But I was talking about radical reconstruction and the creation of public education, the creation of what we now call HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. And the economic development that took place within that period. But of course, in 1877, radical reconstruction was overturned. And it was not only overturned, it was also erased from the historical record. And therefore, in the 1960s, we confronted issues that should have been resolved in the 1860s. And as a matter of fact, the KKK and the racial segregation that was so dramatically challenged during the era of the 60s was produced not during slavery, but in the aftermath of slavery in an attempt to manage free black people who otherwise would have been far more successful in pushing for democracy for all people in this country. And so the failure of radical reconstruction was not simply the failure to incorporate former slaves into society, it was a fundamental failure of democracy. It was an attempt to thwart the promise of democracy that the struggles of black people represented. And so we can talk about the dialectical development of the black liberation movement. And everyone refers to the 60s as the civil rights movement, right? And at the time, we called it the freedom movement. There's been an attempt to co-opt that movement and to squeeze it in to a much smaller frame, the frame of civil rights. This, of course, is not to say that civil rights is not immensely important, but freedom is still more expansive than civil rights. And as that movement grew and developed, it was inspired by, and in turn inspired, liberation struggles in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in Australia. And so it was not only a question of acquiring the formal rights to fully participate in society, but rather it was also about the 40 acres and a mule that dropped out of the abolitionist agenda in the 19th century. It was also about free education and free health care and affordable housing. And it was also about ending the racist police occupation of Black communities. And so, in the 1960s, organizations like the Black Panther Party were created. And if one looks at the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, you see demands for, number one, freedom, number two, full employment, number three, an end to the robbery by the capitalists of our Black and oppressed communities, number four, decent housing, fit for the shelter of human beings. Number five, education, decent education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches us our true history and our role in the present day society. Number six, we want completely free health care for all Black and oppressed people. Number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and the murder of Black people, other people of color, all oppressed people inside the United States. Number eight, we want an immediate end to all wars of aggression. Number nine, we want freedom for all Black and oppressed people now held in U.S. federal, state, county, city, and military prisons and jails. We want trials by a jury of peers for all persons charged with so-called crimes under the laws of this country. And then number 10, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Now, this program recapitulated abolitionist agendas of the 19th century, and it continues to resonate in the 21st century. Interestingly, the Black Panther Party was founded in 1966. So 3 years from now, will we be observing the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party? Well, you know, let me say that some movements can be represented as having already achieved their goals, and those are the movements that are written into the narrative of the struggle for democracy in this country. Those whose agendas continue to resonate today are marginalized. So why don't we ask President Obama whether there will be official observances of the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party. But let me, I know I have to wind up because I'm running out of time. And
now just keep going, you're good.
Well, I spoke about Herman Wallace, who of course was a member of the Black Panther Party. I also want to evoke other members of the Black Panther Party, Mir Abu-Jamal, whose freedom we should continue to demand, Assata Shakur, who received asylum in Cuba after escaping from a U.S. prison many, many years ago. She was just recently designated at the age of 66, one of the 10 most dangerous terrorists in the world. Now that should tell you something about the function of the ideological category of terrorism. Because I want to know why It is never acknowledged that the white supremacists who planted bombs that destroyed lives and homes and churches are never referred to as terrorists. If you want to talk about terrorism, look at the history of this country, and until we face the fact that our history is saturated with terrorism, we will never be able to resolve the problem of racism in the U.S. And so acknowledging continuities between 19th century anti-slavery struggles, 20th century civil rights struggles, and 21st century abolitionist struggles requires a challenge to the closures that isolate the freedom movement of the mid-20th century from the century preceding and the century following. But it is incumbent upon us not only to recognize these temporal continuities, but also to recognize horizontal continuities, links with a whole range of social movement struggles today. And of course, we need to point to the ever more influential movement to abolish prisons and the entire prison industrial complex. So this means that we have to stop referring to movements in defense of prisoners' rights as prison reform. We always talk about prison reform, don't we? But prison reform is partially responsible for the state of prisons today, because prison reform has been happening as long as there have been prisons in this country. And that is to say, since the era of approximately the American Revolution. So, prison abolition, not prison reform. Abolish prisons. Abolish the structures of racism that have fueled the highly profitable prison industry. Abolish the sexism that is at the core of the prison industry, as well as the homophobia and transphobia that is regularly reanimated by the prison industry. And I understand that in this city, one of the most important social movement struggles today, and this is true for the entire country, is the fight for immigrant rights. New Orleans, is an especially important arena for this struggle, given the significant numbers of immigrants who assisted in the post-Katrina recovery work. And I understand that now ICE conducts regular raids in New Orleans. And that recently there was a protest here against ICE raids. And I understand that immigrant workers won a victory against Sheriff Guzman of the Orleans Parish Prison. And they won an agreement that the jail would no longer cooperate with ICE holds. And this is the first southern city to do this. Before I conclude, I want to specifically mention connections across national borders. And I want to mention the ongoing struggles in Palestine, where not too long ago, Palestinian freedom riders, following the example of U.S. freedom riders in 1961, set out to contest the apartheid practices on the part of the State of Israel. And so I want to emphasize the connections between our struggles here and the struggles of our Palestinian sisters and brothers. Palestinians and Israel are subject to the technologies that are controlled by transnational corporations, and specifically I will name one, the largest security company in the world, G4S. G4S, which has a subsidiary in the US called G4S Secure Solutions. And that company has offices all over the country, including right here in New Orleans. It owns and operates juvenile facilities. And I could go on and I could tell you about the fact that G4S, which owns and operates prisons and all kinds of security agencies and services all over the world, is the third largest private corporation in the world. What is the first largest private corporation? Well, you should know. Walmart. Walmart is the world's largest private corporation. The second one is Foxconn. And the third one is G4S. And I could tell you a lot about G4S, but that would be the beginning of another talk, which I we'll have to wait, maybe another time. So let me conclude by emphasizing the importance of comprehending intersections and connections. And feminism urges us to grasp these connections of phenomena that often appear to have little to do with each other, but we realize that they are very much related. These intersections and connections across time and space that bring us all together to constitute a powerful and vibrant community of resistance dedicated to an indivisible struggle for freedom. And so, in conclusion, in the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Thank you very much.